KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. We speak to the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Trump officials will appear before the committee today as they defend their use of a commercial messaging app to discuss military strikes. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump has said many times that he has a mandate. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel, but he had the closest popular vote margin in more than 50 years. How much leeway will voters give him and the Republican Party? HUD says it's going to start targeting immigrants without legal status in subsidized housing. Plus, will China seize on perceived chaos in the U.S.? It's Wednesday, March 26th. Happy birthday to the Supreme Queen of Motown. Diana Ross turns 81. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump's national security adviser, Mike Waltz, says he's taking responsibility for creating a text group that talked about secret war plans. The group used the commercial messaging app Signal to exchange information. A journalist was inadvertently included on that chat. Waltz told Fox News' Laura Ingraham that he built the Signal chat group, not a subordinate.
Was there a mistake? Absolutely. We're going to improve it. We're going to fix it. And we're going to move forward to achieve the president's agenda.
Top Trump administration officials were on the Signal chat, including Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. Both will testify before a House committee today. A note, the CEO of NPR, Catherine Marr, also chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation. Vice President Vance says he plans to join his wife on a trip to Greenland this week. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports Greenland has gotten a lot of attention since President Trump began talking about acquiring the Danish territory.
Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark. In a White House video, the vice president says he will look into, quote, security at the U.S. Space Force base there.
A lot of other countries have threatened Greenland, have threatened to use its territories and its waterways to threaten the United States, to threaten Canada, and of course to threaten the people of Greenland. So we're going to check out how things are going there.
Greenlandic leaders were already expressing concern that National Security Advisor Mike Waltz would travel to Greenland later this week, as President Trump has ramped up rhetoric of wanting to annex the island. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The White House.
The CEOs of NPR and PBS will appear today before a House Subcommittee on Government Efficiency. It's chaired by Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. As NPR's Scott Newman reports, the heads of the largest U.S. public broadcasting networks will be there to answer questions about perceived political bias.
NPR CEO Catherine Marr and PBS President and CEO Paula Kerger will appear on Capitol Hill before Georgia Republican Greens Delivering on Government Efficiency Subcommittee. Green and several of her GOP colleagues have accused the public broadcasters of a left-wing bias in their news and cultural programming. The hearing is part of a larger Republican led push to eliminate federal funding for public broadcasting. NPR receives about 1% of its operating revenue directly from the federally funded Corporation for Public Broadcasting, while PBS receives about 16% of its funds from the CPB. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has signed a new executive order on voting. It requires voters to show proof of citizenship when they register to vote using the federal form. Trump has made baseless claims about large numbers of non-citizens voting. To be clear, such cases are extremely rare. Voting rights advocates say Trump does not have the authority to do this, and legal challenges are expected. You're listening to NPR. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem will visit a prison today in El Salvador. This is where more than 200 Venezuelan migrants were sent after they were deported from the U.S. President Trump deported them using a disputed wartime power. A federal judge has put a temporary hold on that power. South Korea is battling some of the worst wildfires in that country's history. NPR's Sae-woon Gong reports from Seoul at least 24 people have been killed since Friday.
Some of the large fires that broke out in South Korea's Gyeongsang province are still burning. The biggest one started in the southeastern town of Uiseong and has spread fast toward the north and the east due to strong winds. That fire and two other major wildfires have together burned more than 90,000 acres. A sudden rise in temperature over the past week from low 30s to 75 degrees had dried up the forests. Authorities evacuated tens of thousands of residents. Sections of highways and railways are closed off. Hundreds of buildings are destroyed, including national heritage assets. Officials say the victims include four firefighters and one pilot whose firefighting helicopter crashed. Seungkong, NPR News, Seoul.
Thousands of people turned out in Hungary's capital yesterday. They marched in Budapest against a proposed law that would ban the annual Pride March supporting the LGBTQ community. Hungarian lawmakers passed the law last week, saying the Pride March could be harmful to children. The protest march held yesterday is the second in a week to support the Pride event. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. After 3 days of negotiations in Saudi Arabia, the White House announced new progress toward its goal of a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine.
In the latest, both have tentatively agreed to stop fighting in the Black Sea and allow free commercial shipping through that region to resume.
Joining us to fill in the details is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Charles, welcome.
Morning, Michelle.
So what does this deal do, at least according to the White House?
Well, I think it's important to look at it in a broader context. You know, Trump returned to office in January saying he wanted an end to the war in Ukraine. His efforts to craft a full ceasefire didn't work out, so the White House has really shifted tactics. It's pursuing smaller, limited ceasefires that work towards a wider peace. So last week, it was that deal to end attacks on energy infrastructure, at least in theory. It hasn't quite held. And now the latest deal involves maritime passage through the Black Sea. Kyiv and Moscow both promised to ensure safe passage to commercial vessels. The catch, and it's a big one, is it's not clear when the partial ceasefire would begin or if conditions to put the deal in place could be met.
What would those conditions be?
Well, they mostly come from the Russian side. The Kremlin issued a statement in which it made clear the deal would only come into force once the U.S. had lifted all sorts of sanctions-related entanglements to Russian maritime trade that were put in place because of Russia's invasion of its neighbor. Things like plugging Russia's state agricultural bank back into the international payment system, giving access to Russian sea vessels in foreign ports, even just solving problems like getting Russian ships insured to haul cargo around the world. So, you know, in essence, Moscow is demanding the U.S. resolve all sorts of complaints that had doomed an earlier United Nations brokered deal that tried to get Russian and Ukrainian grain and fertilizer out to world markets in the first year of the war. That's when there were real concerns about global food shortages.
So, look, if I hear you correctly, we're talking sanctions relief for Russia, and that would be a huge concession, wouldn't it?
It is, but even for Trump, speaking yesterday, he sounded somewhat unsure the U.S. could meet all the Russian demands.
They will be looking at them, and we're thinking about all of them right now. There are about five or six conditions.
You know, the truth here is that the U.S. can't really remove all these barriers without European allies agreeing to do much the same. And Europe remains far more skeptical of Moscow and supportive of Kyiv. Meanwhile, Ukraine, you know, it's objected to what it sees as unilateral sanctions relief for Russia by the U.S. You know, perhaps with that in mind, the White House also addressed Ukrainian demands, saying it would work towards the return of Ukrainian children and prisoners of war held by Russia. That's something that Kyiv has been asking Trump to press Moscow on really ever since he came into office, vowing to end the war.
But meanwhile, the fighting does go on in Ukraine.
You know, it does. Both Moscow and Kyiv have accused one another of violating that energy infrastructure ceasefire, just as both have continued attacks on targets outside of that agreement. And because of all that, there's a lot of skepticism on both sides this latest ceasefire deal will work. In fact, sometimes it feels like the Trump administration is its own best cheerleader in this process, optimistic, whatever the truth on the ground.
That is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Charles, thank you.
Thank you.
Less than an hour ago, The Atlantic published the texts from a group chat on the private messaging app Signal in which top U.S. defense and intelligence officials shared exact times of planned airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen before they happened that same day. The Atlantic's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, said he made the decision to publish the texts after numerous administration officials asserted he was lying about the fact that these plans were shared in that group chat that included him, apparently, by accident. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said nobody was texting war plans, unquote. The incident is raising questions about the administration's use of Signal to discuss highly sensitive plans. Here's President Trump with reporters late yesterday.
I don't think it's something we're looking forward to using again. We may be forced to use it. You may be in a situation where you need speed as opposed to gross safety. And you may be forced to use it, but generally speaking, I think we probably won't be using it very much.
Yesterday, senators also questioned top intelligence officials. And at that time, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, said no classified information was shared in that group chat. President Trump has said the same thing. Later this morning, the House Intelligence Committee will get a chance to question those same officials who were in that group chat. Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut is the top Democrat on that panel, and he joins me now. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
Have you had a chance to review these texts that were just published in The Atlantic?
I have, yeah. And needless to say, what we see this morning is inconsistent with what we were told by the intelligence community leaders yesterday and, you know, is just beyond the pale in terms of information that was put at risk.
I mean, reading these texts, I'm reading exact times, you know, time now, weather is favorable, just confirmed with CENTCOM, which is Central Command. We are a go for mission launch. And then times of bombings. Is this something that would be typically classified?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And classified at the highest levels. It's not hard to understand why. Because if that information were to escape, were it to be taken by the Russians or the Chinese, it could be instantly conveyed to the Houthis, who are actually pretty sophisticated. And so how do the Houthis respond to that? Frankly, any enemy that is about to be attacked by the United States that has given warning, because for 3 days officials have been putting the information up on Signal. So what happens? The Russians convey the information to the Houthis. The Houthis now know to move everybody and to move their equipment, to move their anti-aircraft equipment to a place where they might be able to shoot down a pilot, where they might be able to sink a ship, because now they know when and with what the United States is going to attack. So I can't think of many operational details or many bits of information that are quite so important to keep secret than what we just saw released by The Atlantic.
CIA Director John Ratcliffe, National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, both were in that group chat. You will be questioning them later today. What are you going to ask them after seeing these texts?
Well, this... It's one of those questions, where to begin, right? I mean, with a screw-up of this magnitude, there's only one response, which is, we are terribly sorry. We are standing down. We will do the investigations. We will get to the bottom of this. We will make sure it never happens again. And there will be accountability for the people who were involved. You know what we didn't hear yesterday? A single one of those assertions. Instead, we saw attacks on Jeffrey Goldberg. And we saw, quite frankly, and this is the specific answer to your question, what appear to be, at best, misstatements Director Patel, Director Gabbard were asked whether the conversation included information on weapons packages, targets, or timing. They said, no, not that I'm aware of. No precise operational details. And, of course, now we have the four significant figures in military time, exactly what time the F-18s are taking off, and the fact that they will be accompanied by MQ-9 Reaper drones. So, I mean, just, again, where to start? This is just an unbelievable cocktail of incompetence and awful handling of critical information.
You said that there has been at the least a misrepresentation of what happened. As you point out, military time, mentions of the targets, mentions of successful hits here. Have you ever seen a breach like this before over a non-secured line?
We've obviously had deliberate breaches, which were as or more significant. You know, the Edward Snowden breach, which took an immense amount of classified information and put it into the hands of the Russians and the Chinese, amongst others. So, yes, but we've never seen it from people who are in good standing and leading the national security apparatus of the United States. And then, as I said, we've never seen a response like this, of obfuscation, of attacking Jeffrey Goldberg, of being dishonest, quite frankly, let me use the word, in the testimony yesterday about whether there were weapons packages or tactics or targets discussed. And so, you know, what I keep thinking about, I do oversight, what I keep thinking about is the many, many thousands, millions even, of young Americans who put on uniforms or who go to work for the CIA or the NSA, and what lessons they are learning from their leadership right now, which is that it's okay to dissemble, to be political, to make a colossal mistake, and then instead of owning it, trying to make Jeffrey Goldberg own it. All of those things make America considerably less safe.
Now, President Trump says he stands by National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who told Fox News he actually accepts full responsibility for building the group chat. Is that enough?
Well, first of all, is it honest? In the very same breath that he said that, he attacked Jeffrey Goldberg, the journalist who he inadvertently put on to the Signal thread. Acknowledging it's a mistake and taking responsibility, if it's done honestly, which I haven't seen yet, is a good first step. But then the next step is, again, this is not complicated stuff. We all live our lives in this way. Do a review, an investigation. I promise you, if this had happened under the Biden administration with a Republican Congress, we would now have probably 10 different investigations going. Why do I pick that number? Because that's the number of investigations that they set up over the Benghazi debacle. Instead, we continue to see people minimize rather than saying, what can we learn and upon whom does accountability need to be visited?
Now, we heard the president actually not rule out using Signal again in that clip earlier. A Pentagon-wide email went out just a week ago warning employees about the vulnerability of Signal. Why wouldn't top officials follow their own advice?
Well, that is the question of the day. that is the question. And I think I know the answer. You know, we have mechanisms in the United States government for the Secretary of State to coordinate with the Secretary of Defense, to coordinate with the Director of CIA. It's called a Situation Room. It's called Secure Lines. It's called JWICS. When you read this stuff, what you realize is that it's a bunch of guys having a lot of fun. You know, I live in a testosterone-oriented environment, and when you get to say things like F-18 triggers, 035 weapons release, you know, the testosterone flows. That's what was happening here, and in this case, it put Americans at risk in an egregious way.
Democratic Congressman Jim Himes is ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we should note, NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, in a new book, Amanda Knox shares the difficulties she faced after being convicted and later acquitted of killing her roommate during a study abroad program in Italy. She'll talk about her journey to reclaim her identity from the notorious tabloid stories that defined her for years. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. I'm in the city of Yiwu in coastal China. It's a lovely city. I went for a run this morning around a lake and a park. More to the point, this is a trading city. It's filled with people from all over the world. Just this morning, we ran into people from Ireland and Senegal. They come here making arrangements to buy consumer goods to ship to their home countries. And that makes this city a good place to hear how Chinese business people are responding to American tariffs. We've been listening to the sound of trade. That's an angle grinder, a power tool, one of thousands of products for sale at a giant wholesale market here. Our editor Rena Advani and I walk through one hallway after another filled with grills, umbrellas, basically everything.
There are a number of different kinds of gift boxes. Some say Paris on them, some say flower, some say Maison de Fleur. All things you could wrap a gift in, I assume.
They're round like hat boxes, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm, very much so. Come in all different colors, very pretty.
The United States has imposed 20% tariffs on everything here. President Trump insists China will pay the taxes. Sellers here expect that American consumers will pay. So there is a lot to discuss, and we will listen to the merchant's stories in days to come. Almost all the news of the early Trump administration is reflected in some way here inside America's great rival. Yesterday on this program, we heard a Chinese scholar of the United States who asserted that stopping U.S. foreign aid diminished American influence abroad.
To be honest, I think the majority view here is this is in China's interest.
People here are also following the news of American national security officials communicating on a messaging app and somehow including a journalist. A Chinese newspaper here ran a story about whether dismay among national security officials might leave somebody vulnerable to recruitment by China. The U.S. effort to take new territory has implications for China's drive to assert control over Taiwan. The list goes on and on. So what do people in China make of it all? Some Chinese may see opportunities for their country, although a closer look suggests some reasons that China might not seize an advantage. Our colleague Anthony Kuhn has been listening in the capital city, Beijing.
The Trump administration's actions can mean very different things to the Chinese state and Chinese individuals. Take, for example, journalist and author Jia Jianying, who was one of the first Chinese students to study in the U.S. in the early 1980s. She says that to Chinese liberals, who like herself look up to the U.S. as a beacon of democracy, recent developments in the U.S. are a crushing blow. But for the Chinese state, they're a propaganda windfall.
It's definitely an opportunity, because what's happening in the U.S. does a better job than state propaganda could do to demonize America as, you know, a phony democracy, which really is an imperialist power.
But Wang Haolan, who was born in 1997, has never seen the U.S. as a beacon. You can sense that in the name of his popular podcast called American Roulette. He researches China at the Asia Society Policy Institute. He agrees that there's no need for China to be in a hurry when things are going its way.
As Napoleon famously said, when your enemy is making a mistake, don't do anything to disturb him. So I think China's strategy will be more of a tranquil waiting.
President Trump's first priority appears to be to cut the U.S.'s trade deficit with China. Here he is speaking at the Oval Office last week.
Well, I'll be speaking to President Xi. I have a great relationship with him. We're going to have a very good relationship. But we have a $1 trillion deficit because of Biden.
The total U.S. trade deficit with China last year was in fact $263 billion, according to the Commerce Department. Peking University international relations expert Wang Dong argues that Trump tends to use tariffs to pressure countries into making deals. And if that doesn't work, he raises the stakes. So Wang says if China wants to seal a deal with Trump, the earlier it does so, the better.
I do think there's a window of opportunity for both sides to really strike a deal, which is, I think, 3 to 6 months. If that window opportunity is gone, then Trump might be tempted to revert back to his more sort of more confrontational approach.
That approach, he adds, could mean using Taiwan or other issues for leverage against China, which could increase the likelihood of conflict. Xie Tao is dean of the School of International Relations and Diplomacy at Beijing Foreign Studies University. He sees an opening for China.
Look at the dismantling of USAID and many other foreign aid projects. It does appear to present an unprecedented opportunity for China to present its own alternative version of a just world.
But Xie says that China's traditional diplomatic approach
also means that you behave very cautiously on the international arena. You don't want to overstretch yourself. You don't want to make promises that you cannot fulfill.
People's University Professor of International Relations Shi Yinhong is even more skeptical of any opportunity. He says that what look like opportunities for China are likely just distractions from its true goals, which he says include maintaining peace in China's immediate environment. He argues that China has neither the money nor the domestic popular support to try to fill leadership roles vacated by the U.S., especially far from home.
China must more strictly distinguish which of its foreign interests are truly core and which ones can be reduced or even eliminated. We must reduce China's burden and focus China's strength on issues that are truly important to China.
He adds that China should try to avoid a major conflict with the U.S. and its allies, and it should try to avoid simply reacting to the U.S. Whatever action China takes, he says, it should be on its own terms, at a time and in a manner of its own choosing. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR News.
So-called marginal wells make up more than three-quarters of the oil wells in the U.S., but account for just a fraction of oil production. But don't let the name fool you.
Marginal wells are not a marginal issue. There's 800,000 of them. Most wells are marginal wells.
I'm Elsa Chang. What makes marginal wells a big deal to oil producers and environmentalists? On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Atlantic has released some of the text messages sent in a messaging app that included high-level government officials, as well as the magazine's editor-in-chief, talking about U.S. airstrikes in Yemen targeting Houthi rebels. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a case involving the Federal Communications Commission. As NPR's Nina Totenberg reports, at issue is whether Congress violated the Constitution when it authorized the FCC to set up a program that provides accessible and subsidized internet services.
In 1934, Congress created the Federal Communications Commission to ensure the availability of affordable and reliable phone services throughout the country. Initially, Congress established an indirect subsidy to fund the program, but in 1996, with the internet exploding, Congress overhauled the act, telling the FCC to set up a universal service fund to ensure that rural areas and hospitals, as well as schools and libraries, have internet access. In the decades since then, the money for the fund has been paid by the telecommunications companies, who pass the charges on to consumers. A conservative group is challenging the law, contending that Congress exceeded its authority in enacting what amounts to a tax. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. A federal judge in Texas says the Justice Department's criminal conspiracy case against Boeing will go to trial in June. The company is accused of misleading regulators about its 737 MAX jets before two of them crashed, one in Indonesia and the other in Ethiopia. The crashes occurred 5 months apart in 2018 and 19. All 346 people aboard the airliners were killed. The Israeli military continues to launch airstrikes in southern Syria. As NPR's Jawad Rizkala reports from Damascus, residents say at least seven people were killed in some of the latest attacks.
The cousin of two of those killed tells NPR it started when Israeli troops, who've already seized parts of southern Syria, pushed deeper into the country. Villagers threw stones to keep them at bay. The Israeli soldiers fired bullets back. A gun battle broke out, and the whole village fled, he says. Syria's foreign ministry says the Israelis also fired a missile at the house. It accused Israel of targeting of civilian infrastructure and called on residents not to relinquish their land. The Israeli military says its soldiers fired only in retaliation and then called in airstrikes. Since Bashar al-Assad's fall, Syria is awash in weapons, and Israel has attacked often. Syrian officials say many civilians have been killed.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, says it is going to start targeting immigrants without legal status. It's partnering with Homeland Security to help identify such immigrants living in publicly subsidized housing. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is here to explain what this all means. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Okay, so tell us more about this new partnership. What are they doing?
Well, it's basically an agreement between these two agencies to make sure no federally funded housing program will, quote, harbor or benefit illegal aliens. Now, HUD says it's going to begin sharing data with Homeland Security to identify such people who are ineligible for housing aid. Here's HUD Secretary Scott Turner in a video of the signing of the agreement Monday.
We have a housing affordability crisis in our country, and so today we are ensuring that American taxpayer dollars are used to assist the American people.
A press release cited exploitation of the housing program, and it quoted DHS Secretary Kristi Noem saying, if you are an illegal immigrant, you should leave now. The gravy train is over. So forceful language, but to be clear, this agreement does not actually change current law or policy, and HUD is devoting just one full-time staffer to this effort.
Okay, so what does the law say about immigrants and federal housing aid and who qualifies for it?
Immigrants who do not have legal status cannot get federal rental assistance, but they can live with family members who qualify. So, you know, that could be certain legal permanent residents, or of course, those who have become or are U.S. citizens, a really common situation. Immigrants without legal status who have U.S. born children, you know, one or both of those parents may be ineligible for housing aid. And in these kinds of cases, the household gets a smaller subsidy, which means they pay a higher rent to account for family members not eligible. But even though the language in this agreement between HUD and DHS is pretty vague, it does still send a message. I spoke with Sonia Acosta. She's a senior policy analyst at the Left-Leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
What it does do is it intensifies already present fears for people who are immigrants, who are trying to seek services. These sorts of things create a massive chilling effect.
And immigrant advocates are worried about that. One coalition called Protecting Immigrant Families says their concern is that the Trump administration might push out some immigrants who do have a legal right to live in subsidized housing. And they say, you know, that could drive up homelessness.
So how many people are we talking about who might be affected?
So one estimate is from 2019, because that's when the first Trump administration tried to bar all of these mixed status immigrant families from subsidized housing. A report by career staff at HUD estimated more than 100,000 people would lose housing aid, and that most of them would be citizens or legal residents, about half of them children. Now, that proposed rule was never finalized, but many people, housing experts and immigration advocates, they do expect the current Trump administration to try again. And, you know, so maybe this new agreement is a first step in that direction. Last night, a HUD spokesperson would not confirm whether the agency intends to renew that push, but they did say that everything is on the table.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
It's no secret that the country is closely divided politically. President Trump won a sweeping Electoral College victory in 2024, but he only narrowly won the popular vote. Despite that, he continues to claim a broad mandate. NPR's Domenico Montanaro looks at what Trump has done and how that's squaring with what voters said they wanted.
President Trump has moved at breakneck speed to try and remake the federal government, deport migrants, and urge investigations of political enemies. His justification for it all?
The American people have given us a mandate like few people thought possible.
We won in a big mandate. We won every swing state. We won by millions of votes.
A mandate. He's used the word in speeches, interviews, or social media at least 50 times since being elected to assert that he has the backing of the public for his agenda. And he's done it at unusual times for a president. What you just heard, for example, was Trump in a speech at the Justice Department wanting prosecutors to investigate his political enemies and during a meeting with the Prime Minister of Ireland. He even talked about it during his tense Oval Office meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, noting how lucky Ukraine is that Trump won so he could try to end the war.
That was a mandate. We won every swing state. We won the popular vote by millions and millions of votes. We won everything.
Lots of presidents have claimed a mandate, and often they've done so from a defensive posture, when they've narrowly won, as Trump did. Sure, he won the swing states and the popular vote, but it was the closest popular vote margin in six decades in this country. That hardly amounts to an endorsement for a bold, sweeping, and divisive agenda.
I think the question is whether Donald Trump's mandate is about
a stylistic approach that he has always taken and that voters have known well about for many, many years, that approach of being disruptive, chaotic, and if, in fact, that's what they voted for him to do.
That's Kristen Soltis Anderson, a Republican pollster. If Trump was given a mandate for anything, it was to bring prices down. Trump promised he'd bring costs down on day one, and it was a big reason many crossed over to vote for him. But with Trump's tariffs threatening to send prices even higher, trust in Trump being good for the economy is beginning to wane.
And now voters are saying, okay, you've been elected. We know you're going to be disruptive. We know you're going to be that wrecking ball. But where's the reduced cost of living I was looking for?
Soltis Anderson says Trump's overall approval ratings have been higher than during his first term, and many voters say they like what he's doing on immigration, but his economic numbers have slipped.
People have been calling this the you break it, you bought it kind of approach, that if all of a sudden he begins making really bold moves on the economy, he also begins to run out of the ability to blame people's economic frustrations on his predecessor.
Trump argues his economic policies will bring back manufacturing in the long run, even if it means higher prices now. But if those prices start to stick to Trump, who's barred from running for president again, that could be bad news for the Republican Party.
In addition to asking voters to take on short-term economic pain in exchange for long-term gain, there's also the ask of his own party to take on short-term political pain in the promise of longer-term benefit.
That's a gamble right now that Trump seems willing to take, and he's using the idea of a mandate to justify it. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
It's been 1 year since a container ship crashed into Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing it to collapse. We'll check in next time in Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. When's the last time you thought about how art smelled? If you're Cecily Bronze, pretty recently. She studies ancient Greek and Roman art, and in a new paper says statues from those periods were often rubbed with perfumes, wax, and oils. Rose was the preferred scent, and Bronze says the ritual was meant to bring the statues to life. It's been a couple thousand years, so the smells have faded, but at least one statue still has traces of beeswax. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Millions of people use StubHub to buy tickets for games and concerts. And if you can't make the event, StubHub says no sweat. You can sell your ticket too at any time. Turns out there is a catch, and it's infuriating users. NPR's Raphael Nam has this story.
When Susan Burke found out Beyoncé was playing a concert near Washington, D.C., she was beyond excited. She's a big fan, and she especially loves Beyoncé's latest album, Cowboy Carter.
I think it's really special and transformative, so I'm, like, especially excited to get to see this album performed live.
So Burke went on StubHub and bought three tickets for herself and her two friends. But then she found better seats, front row of the section. Easy, she thought. She'll buy those and sell her old ones.
And I thought, well, StubHub says that it's easy to relist tickets, so I'll just do that. It'll be no issue.
So she listed her tickets, and that's when she realized something weird. When she went to check on them, she couldn't find them anywhere. That's how she discovered StubHub has a filter called Recommended Tickets that only displays some tickets at a time. It's on by default. You can turn it off if you know where to look for it. And Burke thought, hang on, why?
It's like you'd think you'd want the most options, but I guess their algorithm or something decides that they don't want to show everyone.
Burke is not the only seller confused about this filter. NPR talked to over half a dozen sellers, sellers like Jamie Dawson McDowell in Indiana. Dawson McDowell is a frequent buyer and seller on StubHub. But one day, he also realized he could not find the tickets he had just listed.
I recall sort of like freaking out a little bit, thinking, what did I do wrong? And then I stumbled upon the filter and the fact that the recommended tickets toggle switch is always on by default. And I thought, well, this is a little crazy.
He still can't figure out why StubHub recommends some of his tickets, but not others. Is it the price? The seat? And if he got confused, what about casual buyers? He saw this firsthand when Taylor Swift came to Indiana last year.
There were lots of people I knew who were trying to find tickets who didn't use StubHub nearly as often as I did and were unknowingly not looking at the whole picture. They're looking at just a fraction of the tickets that were on there.
There's a reason for that. According to StubHub, the company told NPR it introduced the recommended tickets filter in late 2022. So now, StubHub only shows what it says are the lowest price tickets and also the best tickets by section. That means buyers will only see some of the tickets. Dawson McDowell thinks that's not fair.
I mean, it's just supposed to be a marketplace for you to sell your tickets.
And he wonders, shouldn't that be up to the sellers?
It does make you wonder what the motivation is. I'm not certain what that would be, because if you're StubHub, I would think selling a ticket is selling a ticket.
That's what Susan Burke thought too. But StubHub told her she should just lower her ticket prices. She's not keen to do that, at least not yet. Not until she gives her tickets a chance to sell.
I'm definitely very frustrated about it because I just want my tickets to have the opportunity to be bought.
Because her tickets are there in StubHub. They're just not easy to find. Raphael Nam, NPR News.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. President Trump is invoking wartime powers to help boost U.S. production of critical minerals and rare earth elements. His executive order last week was meant to gain an edge in a global race, a race in which the U.S. trails China. NPR's international correspondent Jackie Northam has this report.
Greenland, Canada, and Ukraine have all been the target of President Trump's ire lately. Another thing these countries have in common is an abundance of critical and rare earth minerals, and Trump wants them. Here he is talking about Ukraine's minerals.
We don't have that much of it here. We have some, but we don't have that much, and we need a lot more.
Rare earth are a bundle of 17 elements with tongue-twisting names like ytterbium and dysprosium. Then there are critical minerals that include cobalt, lithium, and nickel. All are key components for a new era of technology and in high demand right now.
There's multiple simultaneous trends that are increasing the scramble for rare earth elements and critical materials.
Julie Klinger is a professor of geography and a rare earth specialist at the University of Delaware. She says one of the factors propelling the race for rare earth and critical minerals is the demand for sophisticated defense technology.
Another is the shift to renewable energy generation within the next decade or so. And then a third, I would say, would be the continued demand for consumer electronics.
Think smartphones, AI, and the like. But the U.S. is lagging behind in securing those resources, says Jose Fernandez, a senior State Department official for energy and the environment under the Biden administration. He says the U.S. has just a fraction of the lithium, gold, cobalt, and other minerals it needs, leaving it vulnerable.
Because right now, most of these rare earths and critical minerals are owned, mined, processed, or controlled by the People's Republic of China.
China can and does withhold the export of some metals to the U.S. for political reasons, or say, in response to tariffs.
China's always there for more.
Gracelyn Bascaran is director of the Critical Mineral Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She says China is aggressively searching for new sources of critical minerals, willing to go into conflict zones such as the Democratic Republic of Congo to get the metals.
I don't know that the Chinese approach is to go, okay, we've had enough now. We'll let other people cut in to our market share. They're absolutely out there still looking to make their existing investments bigger, get new acquisitions.
Around the mid-20th century, the U.S. was a major producer and exporter of rare earth elements. But that began to collapse starting in the 1980s, due in part because of growing environmental concerns. Only one mine, Mountain Pass in California, still produces and processes rare earths in the U.S. Hence, President Trump's desire to find other sources. Fernandez says threatening countries is the wrong way to go about it.
It's unnecessary because countries want U.S. investment. It's also counterproductive because if you go to a Greenland and you say, I'd like to take you over, I'd like to buy you, well, that creates a political issue.
And it's not certain how commercially viable the mineral deposits are in some of these countries.
The reality is that in both the case of Greenland and Ukraine, these deposits, they've been identified, but there's been very little work done on them.
Adam Webb is with Benchmark Mineral Intelligence, a London-based market analysis company.
You may have a concentration of, for example, lithium, but you may not be able to extract it and make a profit from it. It may just not be at high enough concentration. And if it does, it will take a long time to get there.
Webb says it could take 10 or 20 years before the critical minerals come out of the ground, a long time in the race for dominance of rare earth and critical minerals. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The New York Public Library is opening up an archive from one of the country's most celebrated literary couples, Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn.
Each of them carved out their own particular identity and niche within the world of American literature and journalism.
Julie Golia is an associate director and senior curator with the New York Public Library, overseeing 336 boxes of items.
This collection has four big different parts. Joan Didion's own writing, all of her research materials and correspondence around that. The second series is John Donne's writing and all of the sort of the mountains of materials underneath those books and articles. A third section covers their collaborative work on screenplays. The two of them collaborated on no less than 26 different screenplays. And then the final one is around their personal lives. And that one, in some ways, has the most diverse materials, everything from awards to baby books to all of their personal correspondence.
Didion and Donne were together from their marriage in 1964 until Donne's death in 2003. Here's Didion in 2006 speaking about the early days of their relationship.
Neither one of us was very well established. And we went to California and did, you know, and started supporting ourselves by writing pieces. So that required one or the other of us to, me to read his pieces, him to read my pieces. And so we began to trust each other as a first reader.
Didion, who continued to write until her death in 2021, was also known for throwing a good party. Some of those details are now on display.
All of the seating charts and really specific directions around the many, many dinner parties she had.
The Didion and Donne archive opens today at the Fifth Avenue branch of the New York Public Library. Galea says it has something for everyone.
From the early letters that she wrote with her family during her earliest years at Vogue magazine to the screenplays that they wrote together, shaping the messages of Hollywood in the late 20th century, to their many, many relationships with different writers and artists throughout their lives. There are so many entry points into this collection, and we do see this collection spurring a golden age of scholarship about both of their work, but also about broader subjects.
And there is more for their fans. A new work of nonfiction from Joan Didion called Notes to John will be published next month. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.